Welcome aboard, my fellow explorers of space, the unknown, and places beyond human conception. I am your captain for this evening. That's right, I've promoted myself. You're just going to have to deal with that. It is I, Mike the Birdman, but I'm not alone. As I trek through the stars, I'm currently hanging out in Starbase 24 because, hey, you can't go anywhere if the warp core is busted. I'm joined across the multiverse in the Alpha Quadrant. That's where it is. I'm joined in the great state of Colorado with
Steve Megatron.
And of course, it wouldn't be This Week in Geek without my compatriot, my co-host, my friend who kind of reminds me of a Ferengi every now and again. There's always profit to be made, and that would be in the great city of Kitchener.
Okay, I'm Alex, but I was trying to figure out where you're going with that.
You're like, never do anything for free, and I like it. And of course, we
that is true. Never do anything for free when there's profit to be made.
And of course, it wouldn't be Future Imperfect This Week in Geek without our latest edition, our science officer supreme himself from the great state of Michigan.
Hi, I'm Aaron Pollier.
All right, guys. So once again, we are here for Future Imperfect, the show where we talk about Star Trek, sci-fi, and all sorts of themes in between in the great worlds of fiction, science, and beyond. So recently, since this year has started, you have heard us talk about Star Trek. Mostly negative, but we've had some good stuff. We're also going to be talking about, in this episode, we're talking about Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1 and some of our favorite episodes or episodes that have stuck out to us. Now, not every one of these episodes is going to be a classic. They may not necessarily make your top episode lists, but for some reason or another, these episodes have stuck out to us. In addition to that, you've also heard Aaron and his wife Darlene's new show, Earth versus Soup, which is a look back at classic sci-fi movies from the 50s and 60s, be they good, be they crap. It is amazing. You'll just have to listen because the word of the day is booger. I had a lot of fun doing that intro.
Is it like a reference to Soup to Nuts or something?
No. It's a reference from MST3K. Crow T. Robot wrote his own 1950s monster movie, and he titled it Earth versus Soup. Okay. And it is utter trash. And okay, everyone is shocked at how bad it is. And it gets made for like $30 in one of the later seasons. And it literally is 5 seconds long. And that's it. Yeah, it's an MST3K reference.
Okay.
I love it. All right, guys. So we're going to kick things into gear, and how this evening's going to work. Like I said, we're going to talk about our favorite episodes in Star Trek The Next Generation episodes in their broadcast order. So we're going to start off with mine, which I think was the third or fourth episode of season one, which is The Naked Now, otherwise known as the episode where Tasha Yar fucks Data episode.
Bitch, I'll never forgive you for making me watch this shit.
Which, okay, it's so weird. Now, going back and watching this episode again, I was picking up on listening to little bits of vastly more or less inconsequential dialogue as to why they're investigating this starship. So the episode starts out where the Enterprise is investigating. There's this red hypergiant or a red giant star that's about to collapse into a white dwarf. And there's been some sort of a starship there has been observing it for a few months, but the star's on the verge of collapse. But they're supposed to go there. They meet, they get a call over the intercom, like, hey, Enterprise, what's up? And then they blow themselves into space because stupidity. And then obviously the Enterprise goes, and they find crew members have frozen themselves to death because they've turned off the environmental controls. They've bled all this energy into space. And it turns out this episode actually has a connection to something that happened in the original series, which is something that I missed the first time around.
You missed that reference, eh? What was it when she makes when Crusher makes the vaccine?
Because Data's going through the computer, and it turns out there's some weird anomaly where gravity has affected how something bonds to oxygen molecules in your blood, so it impairs your judgment. And the Enterprise overcame this in the original series, I guess. And I'm thinking, I don't seem to remember that dialogue, because the last time I watched The Naked Now, I want to say I was in high school or maybe the early 2000s. So it's been a long time. Actually, I don't even think I've actually done a full run through of TNG. I got the Blu-rays for Christmas a long, long time ago, and I reviewed individual episodes when I reviewed them on the show years and years back. But so going back through this, it starts to affect different people in the crew. It starts to affect Geordi first, where he starts acting a little bit weirdly irrational. And then it spreads to Wesley, who can somehow make a tractor beam the size of a laptop.
And ding, 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 we found why I didn't like the episode. As a kid, I liked the episode. I remember actually enjoying it. As an adult, going back probably 20 years since I had seen it in its entirety, I went, oh, this is why everybody hates Wesley.
Yeah, because Wesley eventually barricades himself in engineering by hooking up his tractor beam machine thing to the warp core, creates a force field around the room, and one of the chief engineers or assistant chief engineer, which is a position I didn't know existed, and I don't think it's ever referenced much again after this, he pulls out all the isolinear chips and starts building a house out of them, because why not?
Yeah, it boils down to his arc in this is not only he's the genius that solves everything, which I know that's what people get mad about. It's also, Wesley, do this. We're telling you as adults to do this. No, I don't have to. Na 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 boo boo. But I'm also a genius.
Yeah, and eventually they find out that the star is starting to collapse at one point, but more and more people's judgment is starting to get affected, so it affects Crusher more slowly. It starts to infect Riker because he's touched her.
Yeah, it's not an airborne Picard thing, right? It's a touch-based.
And eventually...
Did they say, sorry, is it a pathogen? Is it a...
it's a contaminant. It's a contaminant.
So it's more like chemical type.
Yeah.
And then one of the highlights of the episode, which is the thing that everybody seems to remember, is Tasha Yar becomes infected since Geordi and her had a moment in the observation lounge where Geordi sort of laments that he can't see things like other people. Like, he hasn't seen depth, he hasn't seen color, he's never truly seen a rainbow or a sunset or whatever, and he starts touching Tasha's face. Now she's infected, so she breaks in the Counselor Troi's quarters, starts trying on clothes, and Deanna's like, yo, don't touch my shit. And eventually it leads to a scene where she wears, I guess, what is the 24th century's equivalent of lingerie. And
she's all horned up and ready to go.
I don't know if I would call it lingerie, but it's definitely a revealing costume.
She's wearing a dress she would go to the club with.
Yeah, you know, and honestly, she doesn't look bad in it.
Yeah, no. I mean, she's a cute girl. I mean, I've always thought that. So she says, Mr. Data, are you fully functional? And obviously he goes into, I'm programmed in multiple techniques and all this crap.
Which again, doesn't quite fit with some of the other episodes.
Dr. Soong, you horny bastard.
this is probably the goofiest episode of the season.
It is, although it's weird because it does reveal some stuff about Data again I didn't catch.
That he's hung.
But they talk about his biological makeup too, because he's talking about his technical specifications, and he mentions part of my biological components function like blood, part of my biological components contain pores, which means certain pathogens and contaminants can affect him just as much as it could a human. I'm say, okay, that's a clever way to write in plot device here, so it affects him. Yeah, okay, fine.
Any of us watching would go in our brains, why is he affected? And they even bring that up, right? And like, why are you affected? And he's like,
That scene though with Tasha Yar, if I can,
of course,
it's actually important, and it's not just Tasha being horny and Dr. Soong being a weird guy for programming Data like this. I don't think that scene really is as impactful until you watch all of Tasha's episodes, where you realize, you know, she had a really terrible childhood where she was sexually assaulted repeatedly on her homeworld. And that she's always been cold and distant to people because she doesn't, she's afraid of actually getting a physical connection to people. And you realize how damaged she is when the only person she seems to physically connect with is Data, the one person that honestly couldn't harm her emotionally.
Yeah, even she knows there's no way that he has any ulterior motives.
Exactly. And it means something, but only after you've seen like the environment that she grew up in and understand her past, why that is actually a very impactful scene. Maybe I'm putting too much into it, but
they did a lot for a character that has so few episodes. Like she's in fewer episodes than what a regular season of a show would have.
Yeah.
So, and of course they do bring her back a couple times, right? Or bring the actress back to play multiple versions, whatever. They've done more to give her character background afterwards, because it's almost like you could feel that she was becoming a fan favorite, and then wasn't there an argument over money or something? That's why
she didn't want to stand behind Picard the entire season and say she wanted the character to do more, become more, but she couldn't get things figured out in the writer's room, if I'm remembering this right.
Yeah, but they did have her background figured out, that she had this awful childhood, and
because they introduced her sister.
Yeah, but they had all that figured out in the beginning. So I mean, that wasn't like it was added on later.
So it's like they're playing the long game with her, and then it just didn't work out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I was surprised how much behind the scenes drama happened with Star Trek during its first couple seasons, because obviously Gates McFadden would leave at the end of this season and we'd get Dr. Pulaski. Yeah. And then
poison for the show. We'll get to that when we do it. It's going to be harder to find episodes from season two, I tell you.
Yeah. Eventually Dr. Crusher is able to figure out the information by looking at the computer data that was sent to her from Data, and she's able to develop some kind of a treatment plan. But the problem is the star is going to blow up. So they got about 15, 20 minutes, and Riker, along with Chief Engineer, whose name I don't remember, and is just there for literally a couple of episodes, maybe, because this is before Geordi is sent to engineering. She's just there like, well, I can short out the door, but it'll take me a few hours. And they're like, oh, you got about 15 minutes. And then Wesley says, well, Data can put all the isolinear chips back in. So they bring him down while he's still screwed up. He says, well, sir, can you do it in 15 minutes? Like, nope, I can do it in about 16 minutes. So they're like, oh, damn. And then somehow Wesley's invention helps save the day because it boosts the ship's power for a minute.
Let's clearly, yeah. Data has that funny line where I believe, isn't it, this will take 1 minute longer or something?
Yes, something like that.
And the look on Riker's face. But also, yeah, the world is and the universe and everybody is saved by his volcano science fair project, essentially. he's like, why don't I just take this and make it really big, and we'll do this here. I'm like 13 and I'm gonna be smarter than everybody on the ship.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you see the problematic elements start to emerge here. And with Wesley Crusher's weird talk boy invention of Captain Picard's voice, which obviously, I mean, the second you saw that, you're like, well, that's going to become trouble in about 15 minutes or less.
Yeah.
It
did feel like that first season, or at least wherever he was in, they tried to shoehorn in, like, we've got to get younger viewers, so we're going to put a kid in, because every 80s sitcom and drama has some kid who was way too smart for their own, you know, good. They did better with him later on.
Yeah. So eventually the star explodes. They're able to go to high warp and they're able to go amongst their merry way. Picard makes a quip on the bridge, say, well, this is what happens when you see a crew give in the temptation, blah, 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 roll credits. I mean, overall, looking back,
don't forget, it didn't happen.
oh, right. And then Tasha says to Data, that didn't happen, which I don't know. I think looking back upon this episode, it's not as bad as I remember. Just
I'll never forgive you for picking this one.
See, I don't know. Man, it isn't that bad. And I know.
It was goofier than I was expecting. I think it is goofy,
but there's like a couple things in this that I absolutely passionately love. And one of them is the deep, well, what will become a really deep thing about Tasha Yar and her ability to connect with people.
So I totally get that. Yeah.
But the second thing is Tchaikovsky, which is the Oberth class starship that they're having to go to. Like, just going to the Tchaikovsky, we learn a whole hell of a lot about the Star Trek universe and what's happened since the movie era into Next Gen times, because Oberth is an SS. That means it's not in Starfleet anymore. It means it's actually a civilian ship. Means Oberths have been moved to generally civilian duty. Now, that doesn't mean that people on that starship aren't in Starfleet uniforms, because it looks like there's like a combined type crew. But that's really interesting. Like, okay, the other part of it is that its dedication plaque is endlessly fascinating to me for multiple reasons. First is it's in Cyrillic, which it's not in English. It's not an English written dedication plaque. It's actually all in the Cyrillic alphabet. That's really cool.
And now, Aaron, for our listeners that don't know what that is, what is Cyrillic?
It's the Russian. It's basically, if you look at Russian language,
the backwards R's and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's a phonetic language. It's phonetic though. So if you know how one letter sounds, you can literally just kind of read it. And at the very least, you can read it out loud. You might not know what it says, but you can speak it.
Whatever. Which again is still, when you think about it, this is 1987, right?
It is 87, but it also.
I was going to say, wouldn't that still? This is still the height of the Cold War, or the end, or nearing the end of it.
Near the end of the Cold War.
So having that even as a subconscious reference, where it's like, oh, that, you know, it's. It doesn't matter what language or what nationality it was from, you know, had Starfleet. It wasn't like, oh, they were all civilians and they were all Russians, so they all died.
Yeah, but they weren't, right? And then if you zoom in on the dedication plaque even more, you realize that it's built at the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the USSR.
Oh.
So the Soviet Union survived World War III, guys.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah, according to 1987 logic, yes.
Well, yeah. But it's, you know, in Star Trek 4, remember that they talk specifically about how Leningrad is dropping in temperature and all that. So my going theory was that the Soviet Union survived World War III and is a part of United Earth. But it's one of those things that just adds into the world building.
And at least Mike, if you're going to pick a Tasha episode, you didn't pick the one where she gets killed by a giant shit monster.
Yeah. Although, yeah. Again, that advances plot. I mean, it's weird. Like, a lot of first season episodes, I think they do tiny bits of world building. And you remember the episodes for the big what the fuck moments, but it's the little things in the background that always become interesting. And like I said, one of the things that, like I said, caught my attention with this, other than the Data fucks Tasha thing, was the little bits of science, since I've become much more interested in space exploration in the last year or two. And I more or less have been looking at how stars develop and everything. And I'd like, because this is really cutting edge stuff for 1987, for them to be talking about stellar evolution at that point. Because yeah, Aaron, you probably,
they got it wrong.
But they got it wrong.
Okay. So it's a red supergiant star. So if it collapses, it's not collapsing into a red dwarf.
That would go to supernova, right?
It's going to supernova, and it's going to collapse into either a neutron star or a black hole, okay? And when a star goes nova, it doesn't shoot off like a little chunk like it did in the episode. It blows, and there's like the whole shockwave thing that will tear apart anything in
the solar system.
And plus, since it's a red supergiant, it will show signs of when it's going to collapse centuries before it does. it's not like it's going to be a surprise when it does collapse.
Well, remember, all we have to do is have Spock put some a drop of red matter in there, and then it would have
it would have been fine. I guess we could have saved everybody on that Oberth class. It didn't have to die, right?
No, but I'll say one more thing about this episode. It's from that era when they were still experimenting a lot with the practical effects and makeup, as well as what they could do on video with optical effects. It has a very Twilight Zone 80s feel for the way it looks. The way the frozen makeup is, it almost looks like they took the kind of effects they used to do in the 60s and then just did it in the 80s.
Yeah. So it's interesting just to see how far we've come in terms of our understanding of spatial stuff. So, because that's one thing I like in one of our off chats, and then I'll pass this on to Steve's episode next. We talk about, like, I ask Aaron a lot of science questions because Aaron has a background in astrophysics, so he understands what the fuck I'm talking about 9 times out of 10. And it's always interesting just to hear what they get right, what they get wrong, how science has advanced a lot in the last couple of years, and how we understand how stars work. And it's just, it's endlessly fascinating to me to see Star Trek try and talk scientific, but not really. So anyway, passing things on, we're going to go next to Steve, whose episode was called The Battle, and that involves the Ferengi and Captain Picard's first command.
Yeah, what I liked about this episode was the fact that you got a little bit of a taste of the 23rd century type style of things, even though it... what I find funny is there's a little bit of a contradiction in this episode. They show Picard in tapestry, and he's wearing, you know, the old 23rd century garb. And then you see this, and he's in this old starship wearing the season one TNG uniforms. And I'm not sure when they made the switch. Aaron might know, but it was something that I noticed later on that it was kind of a little bit different, or odd.
Well, the uniforms changed sometime during Enterprise C's era, because the crew of Enterprise C, when we see them in yesterday's Enterprise, is still wearing movie era uniforms. I prefer those. I think those are actually the coolest uniforms.
Oh, I do too.
But yeah, so it's actually not that far in the past that they were still using them. I think it was like the 2340s when they were still using those uniforms. So, you know, depending on when exactly, what year exactly the battle occurred that he's flashing back to, it's possible that they were using TNG season one uniforms on that ship. That's not a big deal. Anyway,
so yeah, thank you for that. But yeah, so we get a rendezvous with the Ferengi Alliance vessel, and then they just sat there for 3 days, and Picard's getting these crazy headaches, and you never quite find out why in the beginning, and Dr. Crusher's constantly coming in there giving him something for it, and Picard's just sounding kind of like a whiner through the whole episode. Until you figure out that it's the Ferengi screwing with him the whole time. So it's interesting because you see the Ferengi beam over, and this is one of the first instances we get them again. I don't think they really showed up all that much after here.
Is this the first
TNG.
Time they were on?
I want to say they are. There. What was the other one? The Last Outpost.
Yeah,
they were in it before. It was episode 5. This is 9, and they
you
were
let
in that,
your
so.
Females wear clothes.
You're closing. yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
but yeah, then they're referring to Picard's Battle of Maxia, and that they want to honor him and give him this, you know, the hero of Maxia, a gift. And then it's so apparently the uniform thing makes sense if it's 9 years prior, while he commanded the USS Stargazer. And you get to see the ship, and of course Picard's getting more severe headaches the whole time, and Bok just gives him the ship free of charge, but you know, knowing the Ferengi, there's always a catch. And Troy, you know, obviously doesn't, you know, she felt something, but does, you know, doesn't really know what it is, which she's always saying that throughout all the series.
Yeah. My question is, what was Troy's purpose in the show if 99% of the time she just said, I don't know?
Yeah. I watched a clip thing of where she's like, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. And then you get the Riker maneuver. You get Data saying, I'm an android. I'm an android. And Worf saying, let's shoot it. You know,
I think, well, at least with Troy, and I'll say this in defense of the character, I think there was a reason for her to be there. I think the character itself as like a ship's counselor is a really cool idea.
Yes.
Yes.
But the idea that they use her well, the idea that she's supposed to be an empath is never really used well. Like,
no,
maybe the closest time that they used it well was what, maybe Nemesis?
Oh, no, the time where she was like communicating in her dreams with like the other ship that was trapped in that weird anomaly.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. Okay.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. That was a really cool episode. Anyway, we're getting
yes,
off the
yes, yes.
So anyways, the crew beams over. They check out the Stargazer. LaForge gets it running. Data's over there. Picard's reminiscing with it, calling it his old friend and kind of checking it out, finds his old quarters with all the stuff in it, which doesn't bother to check it really to realize that there's something that shouldn't be there. And that brings it back to the Enterprise. And then you get Bok using the thought maker device and screwing with Picard's head. And, you know, he beams over and takes over the ship by himself with no help. And manages to start trying to attack the Enterprise and trying to do the Picard maneuver while he's over there. And Riker realizes it and stops him. And then they figure out what's going on with first officer and
destroy the sphere, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, and it was, you know, they made Picard essentially have to save himself while he's on that ship. But it was kind of cool to see somewhat of the battle on the bridge of what it looked like from Picard's vantage point when he was at that particular point in time.
Yeah. And it's the closest we get like early on to them doing like flashback episodes.
Mm-hmm. And it was quite nice actually getting to see some of Picard's history.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found out while doing a little bit of research on this particular episode, the ship that they talk about, the Constellation class, they were going to use a different ship. They wanted to use a Constellation class instead.
Constitution.
Yeah. And I thought that was really fascinating. And just the fact that this is one of the few times you see a radical departure, at least in my opinion, of what Starfleet technology tends to look like. I've never seen a ship that has four warp thingies. What are they called?
Nacelles.
And I thought that was really interesting. And this ship has been in service since what, the late 23rd century?
Yeah, it's in service in like the 2290s. That's when it comes into service. And it's generally a patrol craft. I can only talk about what I've written about it, but it's meant to be an interceptor, like a fast patrol craft. Because if you look at it, in general, the four nacelles are going on the top and the bottom. They're paired off. At the back of each mounting is a separate impulse drive. So not only is it actually supposed to be fast and warp, it's supposed to have amazing sublight acceleration. In general, you're only going to use two of those nacelles at any given time, but that means that you can go to high warp speeds and switch out which nacelles you're using to let the other ones cool down. So you can like, stay at high speeds.
So it's like a Tomcat or something. It's like a jet.
Yeah. And then if you notice, like, the side of its saucer is super thick. It's a thick boy, right? It actually is. It's like a Constitution saucer, but it's actually a wider and thicker. And it actually has three separate shuttle bays in it.
Nice.
It's one of the few, I guess, would be one of the earlier times we've seen a Starfleet vessel that's seems like it's built for war.
I'd say it's fast response, like it's interceptor.
Yeah, it's more
security.
Yeah. Mission specialized.
Yeah, and I actually think they're a really cool ship because yes, it's obviously kitbashed, but it's different enough that it makes it its own ship.
So yeah, I thought it was pretty good episode. I don't remember actually ever seeing this one before.
And can I
this
talk
is about one of the first episodes I remember seeing.
Can I talk about the Picard? Go ahead, Aaron.
Yes.
Yeah, can I talk about the Picard maneuver? Okay. Because, and first of all, Steve, I love this episode. I think this is a great choice.
Mm-hmm.
The Picard maneuver is like, everyone seems to love it, but they have to understand that it would only work in very, very specific circumstances, because it's about tricking your sensors to believe that you're in two places at once because of light speed lag. Okay.
Yeah.
If you have active sensors at all, that doesn't work, because your subspace sensors tell you faster than light where a starship is. So visually, your eyeball might see two ships, but your ship sensors will show one ship going to warp and coming out in front of you. So if your ship is at all functioning at all, it doesn't work.
So you basically have to be up against somebody with maybe superior firepower but inferior sensor technology, or
they're eyeballing
that,
it,
or hope that somebody is frantic and angry enough that they're working on reflex.
Yeah, but I mean, even if they were working on reflex, they'd be working on reflex from what their sensors were telling them. So the only way it works is if your sensor technology is at least more primitive than what Zefram Cochrane used in the Phoenix.
Wow. Or
all of your sensors are out and you're literally eyeballing it. You're literally having your eyes look out and tell you what's going on.
Sounds like a football maneuver when they're discussing it.
I mean, it's a really cool idea. Have no doubt. Like, if somebody did that to us today on Earth, like, yeah, of course, that's exactly what would happen. It would look like there's two ships, but you'd also see one ship accelerating up to light speed, and then suddenly it's right in front of you. So which one should you be firing at? The one that's right next to you. It's a really cool idea that I don't think really pans out well when you think about it, but it looks cool.
I think it sounds more cool. And correct me if I'm wrong, Aaron, isn't the Picard maneuver in the role-playing game, like, specifically written out?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
It's about, it's basically you're just wanting to get someplace really fast, faster than light, but not go very far. It's just a snap warp jump. So it looks like you're in two places at once to the eye, but yeah.
Would like the Riker maneuver be leapfrogging over top of the ship in front of you to get in front?
Barrel rolling with a joystick with the manual control at helm? Yeah.
Barrel rolling over top of the ship to get in front of it. Yeah. Riker maneuver. The wide berth Riker maneuver.
I don't know. I love this episode. And I like the Picard maneuver, even though it doesn't really work. In universe, it doesn't seem to really work either, but you know, that's okay. It's still a fun episode.
I also like how it expands the lore of the Ferengi. It kind of explains their like social structure a little bit more, how their command structure works, because they talk about their captains and are called captains, they're called daemons. How you're supposed to be loyal to your captain, but if there's no profit in being loyal, you know what they mean? I mean, because his captain's ultimately out for revenge, and doing that kind of means there's no profit if you're dead. So when they take over the ship from the other Ferengi, like, yeah, our captain's a dickbag, so let's not do that. But again, yeah, this was a fantastic episode. I think this is only the second or third time I've ever seen it. It was cool. It was just cool to go back and see different things, like I said. And as Aaron mentioned, seeing a different ship, knowing now that it's built for a different kind of mission profile. I'm looking at it from a very video game sort of thing, knowing that this thing is built for interception and patrol missions. That just kind of gives me all sorts of neat ideas for other things that I would do with it.
Read what I wrote for it in the Star Trek Adventures core book.
Okay.
I guess unless Steve has anything, we're moving on, right?
I guess it's Aaron's go now.
And yeah, unless Steve, is that okay?
I think so.
Oh, okay. All right. So my episode's The Big Goodbye. And I chose this for two main reasons. The first one is it's the first time the holodeck does something terrible and no one should ever use it the way
was it did. It wasn't the first time they showed the holodeck, but it's the first holodeck focused episode, right?
Yeah, it's the first holodeck focused episode, and it's the first time the holodeck screws up and gets people hurt. And it means that Starfleet shouldn't be using the holodeck for entertainment. They should only be using it for training with somebody on a manual cutoff switch. Anyway, the big goodbye centers around the A story, which is Picard trying to relax in the holodeck because of the B story, which is him having to do a diplomatic mission to a race of sticklers to detail, and he has to memorize a speech that is very complex. Otherwise, this species will completely, will go nuts on the Federation. They'll disregard any communications. There's hints at violence that might occur if Picard doesn't get this right. So he's told just to go to the holodeck and relax. So he decides to open up his Dixon Hill persona. So it's the first time we really hear about Dixon Hill. This is a running thing through most of the series and even into First Contact, where he kills Borg being Dixon Hill. It's a really cool episode where it's him starting to exist in like 1941 and really enjoying the world and seemingly not really understanding a lot about it, even though he's read all the books. And then it slowly pulls in other characters from the ship, other officers. You know, you have the guy that is a 20th century historian on the ship, which a lot of people might complain about, like, why the hell is a 20th century historian on a starship, for God's sakes? It makes sense. I can explain that if people want to know.
I always thought, yes, he's a 20th century historian, but just having any historian on a ship would be a good idea. That's a research ship.
Yeah. Or maybe he's going to like a different star base, a different planet. He could just be hitching a ride.
Well, remember, a lot of stuff happened in the 20th century that ended up in space. Space Seed and Khan being just one of them. So it's very possible that Starfleet has somebody that actually has training in 20th century history to be there to deal with any crazed space probes, random super, Ubermensch or things like that. I don't know. It makes sense to me.
Or even just, yeah, and they could find the golden discs, the Voyager stuff, all that. There could be a lot of stuff that they come across, or just like, how many times did they end up finding, was it in this season or the next season where they find the frozen people?
It's the first season. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, they like, it might be a good idea if it's supposed to be the century where we first started using cryogenics. And we shot people into space, then it's probably a good idea to to have somebody there.
Yeah. So it also gets like Dr. Crusher into the holodeck acting, as a learning to be a mid 20th century woman. And the
looks she gives the hollow women in there when she's like staring at their legs and their cleavage and then trying to outdo them. And then she's just like, nope. And she buttons her shirt back up.
Yep. And then like Data gets involved and reads all of the Dixon Hill material. And he's like the most natural in the whole thing and starts using slang and trying to explain it. And it's also the first episode that we have Data and Geordi talk about Sherlock Holmes, it's just a brief aside, but.
Oh, yeah. Well, and did you catch the little thing? The episode I believe was written by Tracy Torme. And the Dixon Hill novels in the universe were written by Tracy Torme.
Yes.
And for anybody that might recognize that name other than writing for Star Trek,
Sliders,
actually was one of the creator of Sliders, wrote a bunch of Outer Limits, Carnival, Odyssey 5, one of the more prolific sci-fi writers of the 90s. And I always thought it was neat that they put a little nod in there that the novel's written by the person that wrote the episode.
Yeah. And so at some point the holodeck starts screwing up. Okay.
Yeah.
The holodeck controls get locked and the safety protocols get broken. So that means, just like, you know, in First Contact, guns can kill on board, well, in the holodeck. And the 20th century historian gets his ass shot, and he's bleeding out on the floor of Dixon Hill's office.
Yeah.
And so they understand now they really are in danger. This isn't really a game. Now we have to try to figure out our way out.
There is one line that doesn't fit with the way the holodeck stuff works later on. And what was it? Their explanation was that if the holodeck shuts down with them in it, they'll get vaporized or something.
I might be able to explain that, at least as I understand.
But it's supposed to be hollow. It's hollow emitters. Like, how would it vaporize their bodies?
Because it's working with transporters at the same time. Yeah, so, exactly. So if the transporter field breaks down, you disappear because it can't hold your structural integrity. Well, it would see you no different than the matter it's creating.
See, normally the transporter tech in there wouldn't do that, right? But if the holodeck's malfunctioning, who the hell knows? Because when you go into the holodeck, you can eat and drink. It's not that it's hologrammatic stuff that you're eating or drinking.
It's replicated.
It's replicating that. If you're interacting with something, it's replicating it. Now, that's not the case with, like, people. People are, like, when they're hologrammatic people. But if you sit down in a chair, it's going to replicate that chair.
Oh, okay.
And it's why you can take props out of the holodeck sometimes. And you see that in some of the later holodeck episodes with Data and like Sherlock Holmes, or why a snowball can be thrown out of the holodeck by Wesley and impact somebody, and it actually is snow.
Okay, well, that actually clears up a fair bit for me then.
Yeah, so I mean, holodeck's screwing up.
And great bad guy in this too. Lawrence Tierney, classic 1940s actor. From a lot of those hard boiled, like, you know, he played the heavies in a lot of those films back then. I think anybody under the age of 50 might only really know him from this episode and from being the main boss in Reservoir Dogs that hires everybody. That's where I know him from mostly.
So yeah, the villain, he ends up leaving the holodeck and disintegrating in the corridor outside because he's now outside the range of the holo emitters. And that's kind of a horrific scene to me, being that he seemingly is self-aware.
Yeah.
And from later episodes, we understand that the Enterprise computer and computers in general at this time can create self-aware beings. Sentient beings.
Yeah. Well, so do you know who I am? Do you know how I am? You can't do this to me. And then it vaporizes him.
Yeah. That's actually a little scary and sad. Like, yeah, he's a villain, but it's seemingly that he is self-aware at that point.
Yeah, that's something that I actually really liked about this episode. Just as the episode ends, Picard's talking to his cop friend who obviously thinks he's Dixon Hill, and he asks him, when you leave, will I still get to go home to my wife and kids? Does this world cease to exist? And he looks at him. He doesn't know how to answer. He pauses for a moment and says, I honestly don't know. And then the scene closes up, and I love the way this was shot. You see the hallway all lit up. The lights in Dixon Hill's office are off. You see the silhouette of the man against the window. And then the camera just closes as the room, the doors close and the room just cuts to black. And then I think the next shot is the Enterprise going across the screen from left to right. And then it rolls credits. And I think that poses a really interesting question about holographic characters, about sentient self-awareness and everything, because as Aaron mentioned, the holodeck can create self-aware characters. I know there's an episode later where they say Professor Moriarty lives on inside the Enterprise computer, though that threat is never ever brought up again.
Well, in this case too, it's showing, you were saying what's scary or you know, scary about how they essentially died leaving and all this. I think, again, as far as creating intelligent life, it shows that even though it's an AI, the strength of character, it didn't even go into self-preservation mode. His cop friend didn't try to escape or, no, I won't let you leave. he stands there, shakes his hand out of respect, and just is reserved to see what happens next.
Yeah, but that might be also the character existing in the framework that it was created in, this noir setting, that he's just kind of dejected and will live in the existence that he finds himself in. I mean, all the characters in there, and when Picard first goes into the holodeck, what you end up seeing, like, remember, there's characters that look at Picard and think he's wearing pajamas, and that he, or like a bellboy uniform, because he lost a bet. They don't see him as a character of Dixon Hill. They see him as Dixon Hill wearing a Starfleet uniform.
And this is also one of the higher rated episodes as far as viewers for that season. A little over 10 million, which Star Trek would love to get now.
This is one of the first episodes I remember seeing. In fact, how I used to watch Star Trek way back in the day. I had one of those giant satellite dishes that were in your backyard, and that's when you used to use transponder channels. Now, my parents had a pirate satellite dish because, you know, old people are hip like that. I was actually very surprised how technologically progressive
they were. Also, remember, in Canada in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot less cable channels and satellite channels technically available to us than there were in the States. Now it's basically parody.
Yeah, so I found this episode specifically on a transponder channel that was broadcasting it to a Fox affiliate at 3 o'clock in the morning on Sunday mornings to put it into syndication at some time, because you could see the local commercials also cut into it with the local kind of promos. You get this generic sounding voice saying, on this week's Star Trek The Next Generation, Captain Picard goes to the 1940s, or something like that. And it was always really interesting to see those like 15 and 30 second promos as well. But yeah, this episode stuck with me for years. And that Lawrence Tierney, I knew him from Reservoir Dogs, yep, where he plays the guy who leads the heist. And as you mentioned, Alex, he's a wonderful villain. And as he's disappearing into the ether along with the Peter Lorre stand-in, I'm Cyrus Redblock. I loved it. And I always love how they never tell you what they're after. They're always like, do you have the item? And it's just so 1940s, you know, detective MacGuffin bullshit. I mean,
obviously the big goodbye is like, it's like the long goodbye, the big sleep. It's a mixture of all of that. It won the Emmy for, was it costumes, I think? And I think it's either, I don't think it's the only, but it was the first episode of Star Trek to win a Peabody Award. So it was at the time considered, at least by critics, the best episode of the season. And you can see why, because it really showed that, yeah, it was in space, but they could do some weird stuff. They didn't have to have every episode be the same story. The holodeck opened up the means to make it about anything.
And see, I love also that they were using 1940s slang in the episode, and the characters didn't understand it just as much as the kids that were watching it at the time wouldn't understand it. So them trying to explain the slang to each other was like explaining it to the audience. Yeah. I thought that was fun.
One more thing I'll say about it is when this, because remember how the premise of this starts with Jean-Luc being stressed out, and they say, why don't you go to the holodeck to, you know, relax? And when he goes and he sees the cars and everything, and he calls a meeting with his senior staff just to gush about how much he loves the holodeck.
Yeah.
And about how I drove an automobile.
Yeah, yeah.
And like Worf's like, what the heck is that?
It's your teenager's neck. Yeah, that's, yeah, yeah, it's a what was the quote? It's a prime ingredient in teenage mating rituals.
Yeah.
Actually, that's something that I want to notice about this episode. Brent Spiner is a frigging joy in this. His comedic timing in this, his inflections, his reactions, like, that man is a superstar of physical comedy.
And it probably let him be, you know, he was probably frustrated with always having to be the robot, right? Well, this lets him, you know, assume another character.
Yeah, and then everyone in the holodeck assumes that they have to keep telling them that he's from South America, and they're like, oh, okay, not really believing it. But here's the one thing I didn't get in this episode. Out of all the weirdness that's in this episode, Worf didn't know what an automobile was. The man grew up on Earth.
Yeah.
Like
explained that yet at this point in the show?
Yeah, I think so. Like, he was an orphan. He was raised in Belarus. Like, you got to think there's at least some Lada's still.
Well, I guess he's raised on Earth, but maybe. Yeah, I was going to say, wait a minute. This isn't a case of he grew up isolated in like some convent or something.
Yeah, he grew up in the shadow of Chernobyl, and
there, you know what, where he grew up, there's probably working Volkswagen Bugs.
Ladas, like I said, old Soviet Ladas that are still fooling around.
They probably, yeah, I'll bet you his father showed him how to fix one.
So, out at the dacha, yeah.
And it just worked. So, yeah, I they could have had a different, I guess, like, who would better to, I guess they wanted Worf because he looked the most alien, but I guess Troy probably would have been a better one to ask.
Yeah, like, what the hell's an automobile? Like, her saying, what the hell's an automobile?
Yeah, because yeah. She's not from Earth. Like, she's like the only one, I guess, in that group that isn't. I liked it. It's a fun, and I think I've seen this episode a lot of times because this is one of the ones that in Canada on syndicated TV, but also on Space, the sci-fi channel, it's aired, I don't doubt this particular episode has aired 500 times on the channel in the last 30 years.
Huh.
It was like every month, at least that once or twice a month, that episode aired.
I know. Okay. So I was just thinking about what you said. Beverly technically isn't from Earth. Technically. Beverly Crusher.
But she'd probably know what she'd probably know what a car was, though.
Oh yeah, no, she would. Does anyone know offhand where she was born? I mean, I do that, but it's because I'm like the master of stupid.
Wait, was she born on the space station?
No, she was born on the moon.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's Copernicus City. I think that's off the top of my head.
Well, if she grew up there, I mean, she'd have to have her head in the sand, but. You might not have a car on the moon, right? Well,
I'm sure that there's like a bubble over the Apollo landing sites where you can still see like buggies and things.
Yes, so. Of course. But yeah, so I guess I think that's probably it, unless we have anything else to add.
No, I'm sorry for babbling about it.
No, this episode's great. It's fantastic. Yeah, I was just gonna say, like, I don't think there's much else except that this is when you said this episode, my first thought was Elementary Dear Data. And then I realized that this sort of, it wasn't that one, and that this sets it up. Because it's in this episode when he's talking about the different sleuths and he starts downloading basically the whole history of murder mysteries. And it's like, it sets up what was to come.
Yeah, and then Data and Geordi talk about Sherlock Holmes, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm sure we'll end up talking about many more holodeck episodes. And then I guess... That was episode what? Was it 13, 14, 12, something like that?
17, I think.
That was 12.
12, okay.
Okay, and then we jump forward to episode 25. There's plenty of good episodes, but we jump to 25, which is mine. I pick Conspiracy because it's the only episode that I regularly watch a few times a year from season one.
Wow.
It's been the one that, I think it's because as a kid, it left such an impression on me. I watched it again mid-90s. It was already in syndication. And I was just amazed that as a kid, they didn't censor half of the stuff that happens in this. But I believe it's a pseudo continuation of a previous episode. What was the episode where they meet with the Admiral? It's when they're being investigated for... It is something or other. Let me just pull it up here because it's two of the characters are recurring from that episode.
It's coming of age, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where they were being checked out and vetted for something. And it was.
Yeah, because this is part one of the alien neuroparasite infiltration episodes, technically. Okay.
Yeah. So what happens in this, they are en route to, was it Daedalix? Six, five, something in this solar system, and we see what might be one of the first times. I think it's the first time we've ever seen Captain Picard sleeping and what the sleeping quarters are like for the captain. And he gets a call saying that there is a priority message, captain's eyes only, and he has to go to his terminal and goes through a few phases of security before accepting the call. And who shows up on the screen? His old college friend, Walker, who's one of the another captain. I forget, is it the Horatio?
USS Horatio, yeah.
Yes. And he's, enter creepy music, playing a little bit, saying he doesn't want to talk on this channel, even though they argue back and forth about it's supposedly a secure channel, saying something's odd, come meet me on this planet, and I want you to come down alone. Don't tell anybody. So Picard is a little hesitant, but, you know, he trusts his friend. It's one of his oldest friends. It was him, Crusher, and Picard that were basically inseparable in college, right? So they were chums. And he goes to the planet, beams down, walks up, sees Walker, and sees two other captains. One is, I'm drawing off the blank at the top of my head, I'm going to pull it up because I remember thinking I was surprised that we never saw them again because I thought they were decent actors. The one guy's from The Hills Have Eyes. Mike, you probably don't because you're the horror guy, right?
Yeah, you know, the guy that played the Bolian, right?
Yes.
Yep, yep.
So they go down to the planet. He meets, let me see if I can pull it up here quickly.
Sev or Rev or some shit like that?
It is, yeah. Regardless, let me pull it up here because it's easier at memory alpha. I thought I had it memorized in my head, but I watched it last week again, and it's coming into me bits and pieces. But essentially, Walker tells him that there is something going wrong at Starfleet. They don't know quite what's going on, but that there's been weird commands going out, shuffling of people around. People on their own ships have been acting odd. People are forgetting personal memories. And they administer a sort of test to Picard, trying to trick him into falling up of what, you know, some important pieces of their history are. And of course, it just makes Picard angry. And then they realize he is who he is. And he says, go back to your ship. Don't trust anybody. And, you know, I'll be in touch. We're going to figure out what's going on. Goes back to the ship. And he's not, you know, he's not convinced, but he's like, he knows Walker. He's like, Walker wouldn't do this. He's not paranoid for the sake of being paranoid. Something has to be up. And he talks to Data because he figures, again, this is another case of, you know, Data doesn't have any ulterior motives. Data would not likely be compromised. So I have a job that's basically for you that only you can do. And he asks him to go through all of Starfleet Command's orders for the last 6 months because that's as far back as Walker believed that something was off. God,
what a task that would be.
Mm-hmm.
For, well, again, for anybody who's not a robot, yeah. Android. So it is a task that's specifically designed that only he can do. So we leave him to do his work, and they continue on with their mission. They say they're going to be a little late. They'll make up some excuse or whatever. He doesn't want to discuss it with anybody because he doesn't know necessarily what to believe, because just in using that communication channel and just discussing that there could be some sort of subversion happening within Starfleet in itself is could be seen as an act of treason. Like they themselves look like they could be conspiring against the people that they think are in a conspiracy. So they have to be quiet till they have proof. And they receive a note that there's an anomaly, and coming out of warp there, they realize that the Horatio has been destroyed, not several hours after they had just met. And he's still being secretive, not telling Crusher that, you know, yes, they went with Walker. And in this meantime, he's counseling with Troy, talks to her because she has to maintain silence. And as they're sort of bringing Riker in on it, Data comes in and explains that, hey, there are some weird, weird movements. People are being shuffled around. Personnel are moving around. Yes, there have been some deaths that of people that seem to have just been reported as they died, and no real investigation as to what happened, or it's like viewed as natural causes, or no follow up. And there seem to be people moving around, and it looks to be that there's a coup taking place silently. They're moving people that are like sleeper cells into key positions. Was it Starbase 12, I think, was shut down for a week with no explanation as to why all the staff had to leave. And when they came back, it was different people in charge. And again, no reason given as to why they did it. There was no strategic meaning for it. And that's when they decide, they're like, we're not sure what we're going to do. He reinforms or informs all his senior staff what's going on. Something seems odd. And they're like, somebody says, it's not like we can just go up to Starfleet and ask what's going on. And he's like, yes, we can. So they warp to Earth. They find it weird that there's no response when they're hailing Earth. They get to Earth, and one of the admirals messages them, and it just seems kind of odd. They invite them down to the planet. That's where they meet up with who they the admiral. What's his name here?
Quinn.
Admiral Quinn, who was from the previous episode, who they believe they can trust, and he's talking and acting a little odd. Not 100% odd. He seems a little almost too energetic for what he was usually like, and Picard pulls Riker aside and just says, it looks like him, it sounds like him, but I don't care what anybody says, it's not him. That is not the Admiral. Keep an eye on him. And then we see yada yada yada. The Admiral attacks was it Geordi, I believe, first? Geordi and Worf. And Riker, and he's got super strength, and then they end up finding a weird gill on the back of his neck. And I might be going slightly out of order, but what ends up being is this whole episode is a parasitic alien that looks, at first it looks an awful lot like the one from, was it Wrath of Khan? And yep. But then it ends up looking like some sort of purple bubblegum thing. But a parasitic race has taken over key people in Starfleet, and they're looking to basically take over the entire galaxy by taking over people in key military positions and political positions. And through some subterfuge and fakeness, where Riker pretends to be one of them, they end up having a shootout and finding the mother creature to be inside of, I forget his name, but he was the other character from that last episode that was in. And he says they seek peaceful coexistence as his neck throbs with some crazy body horror effects.
Yeah, it was Lieutenant Commander Remick.
Remick, that's right. So they blast him with their phasers. I double checked it 3 or 4 times, and it's clearly Riker that shoots him in the face because of the angle he's holding the phaser and where it's positioned when it goes. Picard is shooting him in body mass, basically a standard way you shoot somebody. And Riker's like, no, you get it in the face. Shoots him in the face. It then shows his head exploding almost like, it reminded me of Raiders of the Lost Ark when they see the Ark of the Covenant and the Nazi melts, and then his head explodes, and then his abdomen melts apart like something out of a Cronenberg movie, and the mother creature's inside going, horrible sounds. They vaporize it, and it blows up, and we're like, I'm like, how did this not get a mature rating in like 1987-88 for television? They somehow got away with it. They would not have done that later on, but it's cool to me because of that. That was stayed in my head, and they realized that it had sent a beacon out into space, and that they didn't know where it was going. It was from some unexplored part of the galaxy, and we'll have to see what happens. And then it ends with the sound of like almost like
the beeping,
like a beacon going beep 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 beep, and then it goes, it fades to black, and that's the end. And weren't there, I believe,
there were plans to follow up on the story thread, but they never did.
And weren't
they
there
did
fan
in Star Trek Online?
I was going to say, weren't there fan theories that it was like the Borg they were contacting or something?
Well, that wouldn't have been it. But there's theories that it's related to the Trill symbiont.
Oh, so like an evil Trill.
Yeah, I mean, basically.
They're watching this and then being a fan of other things. This is basically the Gould from Stargate.
Yeah, it is. And honestly, it's the first episode of Next Gen that I firmly believe doesn't really fit in. Like, it just, none of it really makes sense of why it happened.
It's my favorite episode of the first season. And I won't say it's necessarily, when I say the best, I mean the best as in I find it hilarious.
Oh, no, that's fair. Because it's just so over the top wacky that this could have happened.
All of Starfleet Command eating worms.
Yeah. And you're beaming through places and none of the computers are flagging the fact that there's this giant goddamn parasite in each one of you.
Well, wasn't the argument that they weren't beaming? Wasn't it that they were... Well, I guess they beamed up, but wasn't the idea that they were moving ships and moving personnel? So who knows if that meant it was beaming or if that meant it was whatever. But I found it funny when I looked up the ranks of the three admirals. None of them are like the head of Starfleet. None of them are like it would be odd. Like the way they showed up at Earth, the flagship for the entire Federation shows up and it's a rear admiral. And I think two people that are ranked one lower than him. It's not like you would think somebody from the political government would have shown up.
Would have actually shown up.
Yeah, you think the Federation would have shown up, and then you think that they would. Jean-Luc Picard would have had somebody, I don't know, like literally the head of Starfleet would have contacted and saying, "Why are you here?"
Yeah, and it's also an episode that I end up raising my eyebrow at because it's an old episode and it's one of the very few old Trek episodes that confuses Starfleet and the Federation.
Yeah.
Because these things are infiltrating Starfleet. Okay. But you're not infiltrating the Federation. So why are you thinking you're taking over?
Yeah. Like, cause it would have been one thing if when they showed up at Earth, if it was a couple admirals, and if, let's say, the Vulcan had not been an admiral, if the Vulcan had been a representative from Vulcan, or like somebody who was part of the
Federation,
the Federation Council, like the political arm,
yeah.
Like if it had been, it would have been interesting if it was a couple admirals and then an ambassador, or something.
Yeah,
but again, as a kid, I was always a big fan. Again, not just conspiracy stuff, but the idea of, at that point, Starfleet had always been shown as being infallible and nothing could ever go wrong with them. They're basically the perfect vision of the future. This is not like everybody is evil and horrible, but the idea that something insidious could be eating away at them was interesting to me.
Sure. No, I get that.
I also thought it was well done, the whole... Picard being torn between his duty as an officer and then his loyalty to his friend. And that's honestly all I have to say about it, except for the fact that I just can't believe that they showed how graphic it was at the time.
Yeah, because that's a special effect you would only really see in a 1980s horror movie. I mean, you see the effect of the guy's head exploding, and then you see his skin melt off his face, his eyeballs very clearly visible, and then... boom, and then his chest cage or his rib cage hollowed out with blood and gore and everything else, and this creature writhing in the middle, and then it gets vaporized, and then it lingers for a little too long on the body in the chair, and you just see stuff dripping with goo.
The only thing taking away from it is that at that point they went from having the high quality and like puppet prop of the claymation-y type thing they had for the parasite to having these little purple bubblegum things that they just stuck on them like Velcro. And I'm like, that sort of takes away a little bit from the really goriness of it. But again, I am surprised that it aired on regular TV.
I just read about that the BBC actually cut footage from that episode to air properly. And it's that scene. And then Space, Canada's science fiction network, precedes this episode with a viewer discretion warning, the only Next Generation episode to receive this.
So it did get that here. Okay, so it wasn't censored at least, but it did get the PG-13 warning.
Yeah, and then, but you know, here in America, melting people's faces off, that's, you know, Saturday morning cartoon stuff.
But show a boob and oh no.
Holy crap.
But yeah, so that's all I got to say. I don't know if you guys have any other memories other than it's the one episode that stuck out. Like, I saw it, I think, when I was 5 or 6, and it freaked me out. So that's why I remember it so well.
Yeah.
No, I think that pretty much, I think we've said all we possibly can, and we've been going on for quite some time. So yes. I guess as we begin to kind of wrap things up, season one of TNG definitely got some hits, definitely got some misses. Not as bad as I remember, more world building than I remember. And little bits of character development, though I would argue maybe a little bit too far, too few and far between. But the series does eventually pick up its momentum after the second season, which seems to be the case for most series of Star Trek. They have a much stronger third season, though Discovery definitely being an outlier. So we will be hopefully sharing more positive memories of Star Trek kind of going forward. Coming up here on the show in the next little bit, we're going to be having another episode of Earth versus Soup, which is our Future Imperfect sub-show with Aaron and his wife Darlene talking about 50s and 60s classic sci-fi movies, be they be good or crap. They are going to discuss it as best they can in a 30-minute format. We will also be doing more talk on the show. One of the things we're going to be talking about in the near future, as you may have heard in the news recently, the Mars Perseverance rover has landed on the Red Planet after a 7-month journey here from Earth. And the next time we can get to Mars in a relatively short time window is, I think, 4 years from now when the orbits change again. So we're going to talk about the Viking probes, the Mariner, Spirit and Opportunity, and maybe some of the movies like The Martian and just how Mars has been portrayed in the media, but also some of the missions as well. It'll be an interesting discussion.
You have to
be
careful because you might wake up the ghosts.
That's true. And, you know, John Carpenter can cut off my head. So it's going to be interesting.
We don't want the Picard version of Mars where it's on fire, though.
Yeah, no.
Yes.
No.
Mars is almost always either on fire or in like Babylon 5. There's like horrible, horrible like mining conditions where everybody has an uprising. Mars is never happy.
No, very, very, very few things. The only thing I could think possibly is there is an anime called Armitage the Third, and Mars is kind of this weird cyberpunk society where androids are outlawed. It's weird.
You use the word cyberpunk, that doesn't mean happy.
Yeah, exactly. So we will have a lot to talk about that. And then coming up later on in the year, we're just going to talk about more Star Trek. We maybe talk about Stargate. I'm currently working on an interview to try and get the people from the Voyager documentary. I've sent them an email the other day.
Oh, nice.
That's the same team behind From What We Left Behind, which is the Deep Space Nine one.
Where they write a better, in 20 minutes, they end up writing a better season arc for another season of that show than...
Well, that was just the first episode.
First episode, sorry, yes. They do a first episode in like 20 minutes that is better than anything that Trek's written since like 2005.
So that'll be what's coming up here on the show. So once again, we do thank your feedback. If you want to get a hold of us, you can email the Twig side of things by going to feedback@thisweekingeek.net. That is our email address. You can find our socials pretty much on the website. If you're getting this from the Geekcast Radio Network, Steve, how would people get a hold of you?
They get a hold of me, feedback@geekcastradio.com or at SCP21 on Twitter.
All right, guys. So once again, thank you for joining us as we begin to take this thing out of space dock as we explore our own 5-year mission into what the hell's out there. I have been your captain on this voyage, so please return your trays to their upright and locked position. I know it's a spaceship and not an airplane, whatever. So for This Week in Geek, we have begun leaving in the city or the state of Colorado.
Steve Megatron.
Going to Michigan.
Aaron Pollier.
And of course, Kitchener.
Alex.
I've been Mike the Birdman saying live long and prosper.